right, y'all. Welcome to the show. How's it going? I'm Scott Horton. This is the Scott Horton Show. Yeah, it's kind of a mellow day, if you ask me. Well, iron and Iraqi. Things are getting pretty exciting over there. I don't know. I'm feeling a bit like the rhythm of this song. Oh, don't worry. Once I get to complaining, then, you know, it'll get loud and fast. Also, our friend MJ Rosenberg is going to be back on the show today to talk about the Iran sanctions and the lobby on the Hill and all of that. And also, yesterday's guest, that his interview was botched due to, I'm not exactly sure which technical difficulty. Basically, I unplugged and replugged everything in the phone chain, and then I tried it again, and it worked fine. So it was one of those things. But anyway, phone system's working fine. I was interviewed by a guy named Doug Owen last night on his show, using the same phone system. And I was interviewed this morning on Alan Butler's show, in fact. What, somebody's calling? Anyway, Alan Butler interviewed me on his radio show this morning, so the phone system is up and running and tested and fine. So that's good. So later on in the show, we'll have our friend MJ back, and then we'll also be talking with this guy, Tom Kalina, about the missile defense system. You know, I was thinking about it. It's so easy to say, come on, hit a bullet with a bullet. That's stupid. And yeah, I read it in Tom Clancy where, you know, type on paper makes anything possible. But in real life, shooting down multiple re-entry vehicles and stuff, give me a break. But then I thought, you know what? They've had Sidewinder and other air-to-air dogfighter missiles for taking out fighter jets with. Now, I guess they don't move at quite the speed of a ballistic missile coming in from space, although that may not be true either. I mean, ballistic means it's falling. So the terminal velocity of an H-bomb can't be faster than a MiG at full speed, right? And with full maneuverability of a Russian pilot juking and twisting and turning and yawing and trying to get out of the way. So if they can shoot a MiG with a Sidewinder, then maybe the mathematics really are there to shoot down any rogue incoming missile. I wonder if I haven't been critical enough of my own assumptions about what a waste of money missile defense is. So I guess I'll have to ask Tom Kalina what he thinks about all of that on the show today. I bet he's going to say, nah, you're right. It's all a big ripoff. It's a giant ripoff. Look, if you want to take out incoming nukes, use nukes. That way you can still miss and it's all right. In fact, that's really, well, I'm giving away, but that's what a neutron bomb is for, really. I mean, you could say that, I mean, I guess it could be used to, you know, kill all the people in Moscow, but then leave the place open for takeover later and steal all the resources, that kind of thing. But really, an enhanced radiation thermonuclear device, they were designed in the first place for taking out incoming H-bombs, incoming ICBMs, out in space, over the poles, before they land on your head. So, geez, I don't know. Seems like maybe we could negotiate away our hydrogen bomb problem before we really have to develop neutron bombs to protect ourselves from any possible incoming nukes. And how much sense does it make anyway to say that these are only to protect from rogue states like North Korea and Iran, when of course Iran ain't even making nukes or missiles, and that was all a big joke in the first place. But when, you know, the Koreans, they don't have the ability to attack the U.S., and they've only begun making nuclear bombs back in 2003. So this whole policy way predates that. But they were members in good standing of the Non-Proliferation Treaty and their safeguards agreement up until Bush forced them out of it back in 2003. So, well, 2002 and 3. So, I'm not so sure. I think it's the guy interviewing me last night. And I have things to say along these lines. I just, you know, I wasn't, I guess, thinking along these lines as well. But he was just talking about the military-industrial complex and coming up with excuses for their continued trips down to the welfare office. That's really the bottom line, the motivating factor behind all of this stuff. And, of course, that's true to a great degree. And nobody ever really cared whether North Korea was a threat. The question was whether they could use it as the name of a threat so that then they could, you know, make money selling missile defense systems to the U.S. government. And, you know, I've told you about this before. You can go back and look. It was in the, oh, man. You know, I think I'm trying to remember. I always say it's the Washington Post, but maybe it was the New York Times after all. I think that's what it was. It always seems like it's the Post in my brain, but no, it was the Times. I don't know. Damn it. Anyway, once upon a time, say back in 2008 or so, there was a guy who wrote a thing for, maybe it was the Post. And anyway, the substance of the whole thing was, this is all a joke and I'm making a lot of money. And that's all it's about. And we're all just a bunch of welfare collectors, and our incentives very quickly became how to drag this out, not how to get this done. Let's see if we can come up with some more side projects and make even more money. We'll tell the DOD it costs whatever we want, and they'll pay it. And it was, you know, confessions of a ripoff artist. Confessions of a guy defrauding the U.S. government into buying a missile defense system that doesn't work and they don't need. And of course, it's a U.S. government that wants to be defrauded, which is why they get away with it all. But, you know, to see something like that in the Post or the Times, that's not, you know, alternative media, alternative explanations. No, that's the official explanation. Well, what do you do for a living? Me? Oh, I sell missile defense systems that'll never work to the U.S. government perpetually. And what happens is they keep buying my crap and it keeps not working, and then I keep selling them more of it. Forever. Since 1983. Right? Wow, you must make a really good living. I do. I have a giant yacht. I sell missile defense systems that don't work to the government. Anyway, I like that topic. I really don't know enough about it. I really should know much more about that subject, but I like it. It's interesting to me. And this guy, Kalina, he wrote some interesting stuff about it. So anyway, that should be a good interview. That should be a good interview. All right, and then in other news, lots of other news, we've got cops. We've got National Security Agency. I'm way behind on NSA stories. Apologies. And Syria. Lots and lots of Syria news. Syria and Iraq, too. I guess I got to talk about this. If you heard me on Alan's show earlier, then it's going to be a little redundant for you. But John Kerry, former senator, now Secretary of State John Kerry, had a meeting with some senators, and the leaks out of the meeting are that, one, Kerry admits that Obama's Syria policy is failing. Now, if you noticed that he had a policy, I don't know, I guess, congratulations. You know, I mean, any kind of coherent one. But then get this. And this is just so frustrating to me. I mean, come on, guys. Kerry says, listen, the Al-Qaeda thing in Syria is really a problem. But then So his next sentence, you would think, I mean, he's not Ron Paul, the non-interventionist, so he has to intervene one way or the other. So you would think his next sentence would be, we got to switch back to the Baathists to keep Al-Qaeda down. But what's his answer? We've got to really work hard and double down on arming up the moderates. Would somebody show me a moderate Mujahideen in Syria? You know, the Al-Farouq brigades won elections, but they're also cannibals. So, I'm still waiting for the moderate al-Nusra suicide bombers to step forward. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future of Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe, and tell them Scott sent you. What was the only interest group in D.C. pushing war with Syria last summer? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. What's the only interest group in D.C. pushing to sabotage the nuclear deal with Iran right now? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. Why doesn't the president force an end to the occupation of Palestine, a leading cause of terrorist attacks against the United States? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. But the Council for the National Interest is pushing back, putting America first and educating the people about what's really at stake in the Middle East. Help support their important work at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, y'all, Scott here. So you made a little bit of money in this horrid economy, only to find that the Fed has more or less outlawed saving. So into the treacherous waters of the stock market bubble you go. But how to make a little money without too much risk of losing it all? Check out WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who opens a very real window into his main account, updating his subscribers on the facts of and the reasoning behind all his market moves. Follow along on paper or with real money and see what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is the show. Scott Horton Show. Coming up, good old MJ Rosenberg is going to be back on the show to talk about some things. So, yeah, now let me get back to this Josh Rogan piece. Man, I wish I had thought to try to get Josh on the show. I disagree with him and his view on everything, except I think it's pretty obvious he wears it on his sleeve that he's kind of a right-wingy, neocon-y sort of a view. But he is a journalist. He does hard news. His stories aren't always right. But he does have pretty exclusive access to a lot of sources, and he does break a lot of important news. And really, no matter what he thinks of this, this is an important story. He says he has two senators who, and also he has verification. He has verification from Kerry, not on every specific, but on, you know, I guess, the tone of the conversation or something. Let's see. He says, Kerry's spokesperson denied that he raised the issue of supplying weapons, but did not dispute the overall tenor of the conversation. So there you go. So now, in February of 2014, after this has already been going on for almost 3 years, Kerry now wants to arm Syria's rebels. Really, huh? Anyway, America's been working with Saudi Arabia to send so-called rebel fighters with money and guns to Syria for years. And their strategy of backing the rebels hasn't worked. And I think, within context, Obama deserves a little bit of credit here that he has apparently put some restrictions on the CIA, like, hey guys, seriously, try to find people who aren't outright loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri to back in Syria, you know, vet them. But that's stupid. It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't work anyway, because the moderate fighters end up just ultimately being the procurement middlemen for the jihadists who are doing the fighting. Who ever heard of moderate fighters? I mean, you could be, I guess in a state army, you could be sort of a moderate or maybe have no politics at all and just go serve in your state army because that's the custom in your neighborhood or whatever. But when people join up to travel, you know, volunteer to travel to another country to join the jihad, you know, like Orwell in Spain, you got to have a reason to do so. You got to not be a moderate in the first place. And the suicide bomber brigades, the prisoner beheaders in Syria, there are no moderates among them. And if there were, they would have already gotten their heads cut off by now. Again, when John McCain and his staff and I guess the CIA, right? Vetted the Northern Storm Brigade for John McCain to go and meet and show the cameras, look, here are some moderate rebels in Syria. Those guys were veterans of the Iraq War, where they had fought with the Sunni insurgency against the Americans, the Iranians, and the Shia. They were Al-Qaeda and Iraq guys. Again, I'm sorry, redundant from Alan's show earlier, but Mitchell Prothero said it on this show a few weeks back. None of these groups, the Islamic Front or the Al-Nusra Front or the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, none of them have ideological differences. Their only differences are who should be in charge and exactly which tactics they should take and what strategy they should follow and, you know, which direction they should apply their force at any given time. But they all want a radical, you know, a revolutionary Sunni Islamist state, a bin Ladenite state. That's what they're all fighting for over there. And so who the hell is John Kerry talking about? Arming up the moderates. Whose army is he going to put in there? From what white Western European country? Because otherwise, there are no moderates there in Syria doing any fighting at all. If you want to talk about a moderate in Middle East terms, in terms of America's view of Middle Eastern countries, the moderates are the Baathists. The moderates are the secular fascist dictators of the Assad government. I mean, come on. The Baathists live to hunt and kill Al-Qaeda guys. You know why? Because or else the Al-Qaeda guys will kill them. So who's your enemy? And the fact is, you know, you might say no one, but the truth is that your government has made enemies for you in this world. Luckily, there are no states. There's not a single country on this planet that is an enemy of yours. But there are bin Ladenite, revolutionary, Sunni, Takfiri, whatever the hell, prisoner beheader, suicide bomber types who would like to attack America and American interests and kill Americans wherever they are in the world, civilian or military. And so it's just madness to think that John Kerry, the Secretary of State of America, that anyone in the councils of power is saying, yeah, let's keep this up. Let's keep pretending there are moderates to back in Syria against the Baathists. Let's continue pursuing regime change. Is that what Obama told Kerry to do? To go to Geneva and say, oh yeah, no, regime change. We'll settle for nothing less than the current dictator resigning. Like Nixon. He'll just get on the helicopter and fly away and we'll never see him again, right? Yeah, right. That's a poison pill. That's a deal he can't possibly accept. Just like with Kosovo. Remember when I was telling you what a warmonger Hillary Clinton was the other day? This was what was called the Rambouillet Accord. And it said, hey, Milosevic, sign this. It says that NATO can occupy every square inch of your country, including your bedroom. Including your office. And he said, no. And that was then the excuse to start dropping bombs. Same thing here. The offer he can't possibly accept. Is that really what Obama told Kerry to do? I guess it probably is. you know, Obama's the one who said that, oh, Assad must step aside. And he's, let's see, when was the last time Obama personally said Assad had to leave office? It's just been a few months. But somebody tell me how that makes any sense at all. Is this just appeasing Benjamin Netanyahu? Listen, we're going to make friends with Iran, but don't worry, we're going to get rid of Assad. And that doesn't even make any sense anyway. How about, hey, listen, we're going to make friends with Iran, and then we're going to make Iran make Syria to quit backing Hezbollah so much. They've offered that. Way back 11 years ago, the Iranians said, hey, you know what? If you guys want to be friends again, we could be friends again. And you know what we'll do? We'll negotiate any part of our nuclear program. This was back when it hardly existed at all. We'll negotiate the nuclear program that we're considering starting. And we'll work with you on invading Iraq. Wink, wink. And, you don't like Hezbollah messing around on Israel's northern border, or existing on Israel's northern border? Fine. We'll put all pressure on Hezbollah and Hamas to lay down their weapons and simply become political parties instead of sub-state militia groups. That was the Iranians' offer back 11 years ago. You know, don't you wonder, don't you want to be a fly on the wall or see a leak one time about what is it that John Kerry and Benjamin Netanyahu talk about for 10 hours when they talk for 10 hours? Are they all friends and they're just plotting what they're going to tell us later? And they see eye to eye on everything? Or has John Kerry had it up to here with Benjamin Netanyahu? Does he ever try to explain things like, hey, listen, man, I know you don't like Hezbollah, but if I can befriend Iran, and I can find a way to get Iran to pressure Hezbollah to stop being such a hassle for you, then maybe that would be all right. I mean, what are you going to do? 2006 again? Invade southern Lebanon and destroy them once and for all? Because we saw what happened last time. You just made them more powerful than they were before by giving them a chance to whoop the IDF's sorry ass in front of everyone and drive them out within, what, 2.5 weeks? So, and you know what? Not that this would matter to the Israelis, but it was Ariel Sharon's policy in invading Lebanon and staying that's responsible for the rise of Hezbollah in the first place. There was no Hezbollah back in the days of Jesus, or back in the days of World War II, or back in the days of Gerald Ford or Jimmy Carter. Hezbollah was invented in the 80s by the Lebanese Shia resistance to the Israeli invasion. And of course, the Israelis were invading just to go after the PLO. But they stayed, and they treated the local Shia like dogs. So they formed the Party of God. You know, not that that was very predictable or anything. But anyway, I would like a leak like that. That's what I want to see. I want to see a State Department cable about, you know, someone, not necessarily the Secretary of State, but somebody had to sit and deal with Netanyahu for 10 hours. This is what they discussed. And, you know, by the way, we think he's back on his meds or not, or what, you know? I want to see what's in there. You know, I know one good one was from back, that is in the WikiLeaks. This is the first thing Larissa found, my wife, Larissa Alexandrovna. Found when the State Department cables were leaked back in 2010. She just plugged in Iran, Israel, let's see what we find. And it was in 2007, the Israelis threatening, Mayor Dagon, the head of Mossad, threatening Nicholas Burns, saying if you don't start the war, and this would have been August 2007, if you don't start the war against Iran, maybe we'll start it for you. Wouldn't you prefer to go ahead and start the war on your own terms with your own plans instead of being dragged into it by us? Whoa. It's amazing to me how rarely American diplomats smack the Israelis in the face. What did you just say to me? Smack! I mean, seriously. Chutzpah, that's what they call it.
He has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR silver commodity discs. The first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make the show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. Today's show is brought to you in part by Audible.com. You get a free audiobook download at audibletrial.com/Scott. Audible has over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. For Scott Horton Show listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with their free 30-day trial. I personally recommend Dirty Wars by Jeremy Scahill. It's great for anyone wanting the inside story on the cruel and counterproductive terror war of the Obama years. You can sign up for a free 30-day trial and download Dirty Wars at no charge by going to audibletrial.com/Scott. That's audibletrial.com/Scott. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. This just in, breaking extra, extra study. Less war improves mental health of soldiers. So it was the wars that were the problem with their mental health there. That makes sense, you know, now that I think about it. Anyway, my website is scotthorton.org. Scotthorton.org for all my interview archives and the blog and the chat room and all that. Scotthorton.org/chat if you want to hang out with everybody during the show there. All right, our first guest on the show today is our good friend MJ Rosenberg, and he writes mostly, I think, at Huffington Post and also at MJ, spell it out, jrosenberg.com. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Okay, Scott, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Appreciate you joining us here today.
I'm really in a good mood today, so you got me in a good day.
Okay, well, why are you in such a good mood? We'll start with that.
Well, because the New York Times today, you know, on the front page of their website, had the news that AIPAC, the Israel lobby, is in some serious trouble and has been losing, you know, one battle after another. And although I've known it and reported about that and everything, it really matters when it's in the New York Times, and that, I mean, it also means that it is really happening on this issue, because the New York Times tends to be scared to write anything about this stuff. And here it is on the front page of the blog: AIPAC in trouble. So I'm happy.
And that's in the world section or the national? Because I didn't see it. I'm looking for it now.
If you have on the physical newspaper, it's on page 4, and it's on the website, it's on page 1.
Oh, okay.
But it's big news, so...
that's great. Now, here's the thing about that. A lot of people never heard of AIPAC before, AIPAC, or they don't even know what to call it. What the hell is an AIPAC anyway, MJ?
Well, AIPAC is another way of saying the Israel lobby, or the Jewish lobby. Jewish lobby isn't very accurate, but Israel lobby. American Israel Public Affairs Committee is the... When we talk about the lobby, it's the only actually registered lobby for Israel in the United States. And we talk about Congress being led around by the nose by the lobby. We're talking about AIPAC. And they're the only, you know, the other good news that happened on Sunday was that, miracle of miracles, Hillary Clinton came out in support of Iran negotiations, despite AIPAC's vehement opposition. What was very amusing about it and shows the power of AIPAC is she dropped the news that she's supporting Obama's negotiations during the Super Bowl, hoping that nobody would see it, I guess. But it was just very strange.
Yeah, that's interesting, the politics. I noticed that Rand Paul did the same thing. He came out against the sanctions after it was already too late, and Harry Reid had already announced he wasn't going to schedule them anyway.
Yeah.
So they both want to be able to say, no, I supported the president on that. So that's good that they both seem to think that it's going to happen. But then, yeah, it's also interesting that they both waited and they didn't want to come out against the sanctions and in support of the president. Too bad, because that might anger the lobby and they have a long
memory.
That's
the only reason. The lobby's the only people who were against these negotiations. There's nobody else. It's just them. Oh, yeah, actually, the lobby's against it. The Saudis are against the negotiations, and the crazed militants in Iran who are against the current president, they're also against these negotiations. But that's it.
Right.
It's pretty but the only one that matters of the three is AIPAC. So that's why front page news, and the headline says, potent pro-Israel group finds its momentum blunted.
So. Okay, and so they've had a string of losses, too, because when you say they're the only ones pushing for these sanctions now, you could say the same thing about pushing for the conflict with Syria last summer that thankfully didn't happen. But
yeah, exactly.
I was searching in vain for even word. I guess, well, no, I mean, I saw on the news that Raytheon's stock was up on the anticipation of the crisis, but, you know, breaking out, but I never saw, I don't think, anything about the arms manufacturers themselves really pushing for the conflict. I'm not trying to acquit them, but I'm just saying, as far as all the media at the time, all I could tell was there was Obama, and then there was the Israel lobby who wanted that war, and nobody else,
and
all the way to San Diego.
Himself, you know, who's always just screaming and hollering, and they're really getting at, I mean, they're really, over. The Netanyahu government is really getting nervous. I think now I don't want to be too optimistic because this administration always disappoints me when I'm optimistic. But it appears right now that that Obama and Kerry have decided that they might as well just take on a lobby. I mean, this Iran thing they really want to do, and I think they're seeing, well, once we're battling them on that, we might as well, you know, battle them on Israel-Palestine too. And Kerry is supposedly, according to Tom Friedman, who obviously has great sources and a lot of other reporters, the administration is about to lay its own peace plan for Israel-Palestine on the table. And the Israelis are pretty nervous about that, too. So maybe it's a new day, but I don't like to predict things like that because they never turn out.
Yeah, well, you know, I think... It certainly seems like, as you wrote in your article, of what it took for Obama to win on the question of the sanctions was, even really before the State of the Union, was he made it clear that, look, I'll veto this, and look, I don't appreciate it, this is serious, and these sanctions, I don't care if you say that you're just trying to help, it doesn't help, so
right.
Back off. And they backed off. That's pretty good for Barack Obama to tell anybody to back off when they're trying to prevent him from doing something right. I've never heard of such a thing. So,
no.
I mean, that really is great. And I sure would like to see him, you know, keep that attitude up through, you know, whatever end negotiation they come up with, since the Iranian nuclear program isn't a threat anyway. I don't care what's in the negotiation as long as the Americans aren't mad anymore at the end of it. You know, their fake claims are satisfied or what have you. But I wonder if you think that they're that serious about the Palestine thing. Because it seems to me, I mean, look, you're dealing with Benjamin Netanyahu. So unless they say, listen, we're never selling you another airplane and we're never giving you another dollar out of Scott Horton's paycheck ever again, pal, unless you give up the West Bank. Did I make myself clear, pig? Then maybe they could get in the settlements. But short of that, he's just going to say, oh, yeah, sure, whatever you say, Bill Clinton, and then not do it.
Well, I assume the same thing. Unless there's, it's just that I've never seen any Secretary of State as determined as Kerry is about this. I mean, he really seems to have made this. Look, to me, it looks like he's wasting his time. He's got to know more than we know, right? I mean, obviously Netanyahu is not going to agree to anything because Netanyahu wants to keep everything and wants to keep the Palestinians subjugated forever. That's what gives his life meaning. And But Kerry knows that too. And yet he keeps going over there. He keeps persevering. Why persevere on this? Who are you trying to impress unless you think you're going to come up with something? You know what I mean? It's like...
I never could figure that out from the start of this. As soon as he became the Secretary of State, I couldn't figure out what he means by doing this, because think of the strong arm that you would have to really use to get Netanyahu to go along. I mean, nothing short of a real threat is going to do it.
Of course, you know, it's only in this context that the obvious strong arm is never mentioned, which is that we provide more aid to Israel by far than to any other country, and if we threaten to cut it off, they will be out of the West Bank on whatever day we tell them to be out of the West Bank. I mean, that is in fact true. The thing is, the Israelis have no cards to play against the United States. I mean, especially when the United States presents a plan, as they're presenting, in which, according to the press reports, in which the areas that they pull out of, you know, the borders with Jordan and all the all the borders that they're so afraid of having open to the whole Arab world. The borders would be patrolled by NATO. I mean, they're talking about a security plan that's better than they got now. So if the United States, if a president says, look, this is what we're doing, and this is we're doing this for our national interest, it also happens to be good for your national interest, and by the way, we give you $3.5 billion a year. We vote with you in the UN all the time and make ourselves look like idiots. This is what you're going to do. You know, the only president who ever did that in American history was Eisenhower in 1956.
Right.
He did it.
As you say, Obama's just whooped them. Well, I guess Obama didn't whoop them. The American people whooped them on Syria, but Obama whooped them on Iran. So they're not really in much position to object now.
Especially, you know, it's amazing. In the State of the Union address, the whole thing was all about, basically the president saying he's going to exert his power, whatever, he's not worried about Congress. He's going to do it. But he only issued one veto threat. And the only veto threat was, he said, if you send me APAC's, he didn't say APAC's, but if you send me APAC's sanctions bill, I will veto it. He's like, you know, he was like throwing down the gauntlet. He wasn't like finessing the issue. He said it unambiguously. So it seems like he's serious. Mm-hmm. And that he doesn't care that they're mad. Jeez, who are they going to go to? The Chinese? I mean, it's like, it really is. And I think it might start also another factor, which Kerry. Again, where Kerry demonstrated how serious he is, he mentioned the boycott movement. He made a statement. He said, well, the Israelis have to recognize that there's this boycott movement going on all around the world, and if they want to guarantee their own future, they better, you know, play ball here. And, oh, my God, an American Secretary of State uses the threat of boycott? He didn't say he was for it, but just mentioning it. And the Israelis, they went ballistic. Just because he mentioned it.
Mm-hmm. I wonder? Do you think that, or you may even know the answer to this question, but at least do you suspect that Benjamin Netanyahu is a racist? Because I kind of get the idea that Obama gets the idea that Netanyahu thinks that he's nothing but a something, and how if I was Obama, my reaction to that would be, oh, yeah, well, we'll see, you know, who's the big man around here when he's the president of the United States and Netanyahu is simply the prime minister of tiny little Israel.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. If he isn't a racist, he certainly acted like one when he disrespected in his very first meeting when he came to Washington and he lectured. Oh, you know, they always have that thing where they afterwards they do that little press conference where they sit there in their chairs in front of the fireplace. And every foreign leader is going to be respectful to the President of the United States. He lectured Obama like he was a kid.
Right.
Now,
like he was the butler. I got to stop you. We got to take this break, but hold on right there. It's a short break. We'll be right back, everybody, with the great MJ Rosenberg. From MJRosenberg.com after this. Hey! Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I'm talking with MJ Rosenberg. His website is MJ, like Homer J. Simpson, J-A-Y, MJRosenberg.com. And he also writes for the Huffington Post. I'm stalling for time as I look for the Huffington tab here. Here it is. Iran, the week Obama took down the lobby. Yeah. I like that. And I hate siding with Obama on anything, but I sure side with him on this. Where we left off was We were talking about the personal conflict, which, you know, probably I think has a lot to do with this, and I'm very thankful for, between the president and the prime minister. Obama was overheard talking with Sarkozy saying, "You think you hate him? I got to deal with him every day." And I can just imagine, like, Mr. President, Prime Minister Netanyahu on line 3. Oh, Christ, not again. You know? I would hate my life.
And just the idea that he says every day. How many world leaders do you have to deal with every day?
I know.
Is there any other? I mean, Israel has 7 million people. There are countries, obviously, that have more than a billion people. I don't think he deals with India. I don't think he thinks about India. Like, once a week, I don't think he thinks about India, let alone worrying about Israel continuously. And the reason is the lobby. It's the lobby. No other foreign country has a lobby like this. It's a unique organization. Every other country in the world, and this would include even the Brits during World War II. I mean, when they were in World War II and they wanted us to get in World War II with them, they didn't have a lobby. All other countries have are foreign agents who they pay. And the reason that Israel didn't set it up that way is if you have a foreign agent representing you or a whole law firm of foreign agents representing you, you have to register under something called the Foreign Agent Registration Act. And that means every single dealing you have with members of Congress or anything else has to be sent to the Justice Department for clearance. You cannot just go up to Capitol Hill and buy up senators. Also, for other foreign countries, because of that act, it's called FARA, are not allowed. It is against the law for them to have any involvement in politics at all, which is why you don't ever hear that the French lobby is involved in some, you know, on some issue in some congressional race in Iowa. Mm-hmm. They set up AIPAC differently, so it would, even though it's directed, as we all know, by the Israeli government, it's a lobby of Americans. So therefore, by doing this very clever thing of being a organization of 100,000 people and tons of money, all of whom are Americans, they are entitled by law to use their American rights to get involved in U.S. politics on behalf of a foreign government. Mm-hmm. Sounds
basically
complicated.
Am I right that the loophole is basically you just have to pretend that you really, really think there's no difference whatsoever between Israel's interests and America's on any issue?
Exactly. That's it. You know, and we never, Joe Biden, he says it all. Joe Biden's the only politician who's dumb enough to say it all the time. He says, there must be no daylight. I always tell you this because he says it twice. There must be no daylight between Israel's policies and U.S. policies. They'd never say that about, they wouldn't say it about Canada. They wouldn't say it about any country. It's so antithetical toward any country's independence. Israel obviously doesn't feel that way about the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Definitely not.
Yeah, they don't care what our policies are. They're going to do what they're going to do. They fight us on everything. But we must have no daylight between us and Netanyahu. But you're absolutely right, though. I think that Obama, it's a very important thing, is that Obama hates Netanyahu. On the other hand, politicians, I was at the White House, and it was in 1897 for some event. And there was a small crowd afterwards that was hanging around. And I talked to Hillary Clinton. She was the first lady then. Oh, my God. She hates him so much. She really hated him because, I don't know if you remember, during the Monica Lewinsky thing, mm-hmm. Netanyahu, who was prime minister then, as he is now, but he hasn't been the whole time, he came on a visit to the United States, and before he went to see Obama, he went to see Newt Gingrich to help plot Obama's downfall.
Wait, Clinton, you mean?
I mean, Clinton. I'm sorry, Clinton, and was heard that he and was making jokes with Gingrich about Clinton's cigar and Monica Lewinsky and all that smutty stuff. It all got back to Hillary. She hates his guts. But you know what? She's I don't see how that's motivating her. No, it might. It might be. Who knows? It really helps that Netanyahu is such an utterly charmless and obnoxious guy. He's also is essentially a Republican because, you know, he grew up in the United States. He's almost as American as we are. He spent his whole life here. He even changed his name in the United States to have a more American sounding name. But then they persuaded him to go back and become prime minister. But he has American sensibilities to the extent that he is a right-wing Republican. So the racism that you talked about, gee, that sort of goes with that package, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. You know, well, there was a story, I don't know if this is really true, but they say that Robert Gates, back in, was it in the Reagan years or the Bush senior years, told Brent Scowcroft, that Netanyahu guy, this is the first time he ever came to the White House, and Gates tried to get him on the ban list, that he should never be allowed back in the White House again. And they never said exactly what it was, if they caught him rifling through somebody's desk or what.
I mean,
what
amazing.
Must have been going on there for Robert Gates, of all tools, to react that way, you know?
Well, that was in the first Bush presidency?
I'm trying to remember. I think it actually may have been during Reagan. I can Google it real quick. It was it's one of the stories coming out of Robert Gates' book.
Okay.
Let's see. It was Scowcroft was the one he went to. So I think it was during Bush Sr. because Scowcroft was the National Security Advisor then.
Right. Okay. No, I think the foreign policy team around the first Bush, they tended to be much more of the more realistic, in contrast to being like crazed imperialists like George W. Bush too. I mean, so, yeah, remember, Scowcroft was against the Second Iraq War. He wrote an op-ed in the New York Times saying it. And it was supposedly he was speaking for the first President Bush.
Oh, yeah. It was called Don't Attack Saddam, and it was widely considered to be a message from the father.
Right, from the father.
Yeah.
You're talking about some serious psychopaths here, where that's the only way a father can communicate with his son is to have his best friend write an op-ed in the Times. Anyway, the son
ignored
it. I think
Baker tried to stop him, too.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, but right now things seem to be changing. You know, if we're not going to change our Middle East policy in the second term of a Democratic president, there's no chance ever. Because there's 3 years left of this term. That's it. A new president's going to come in, of course, and starts fresh, which means starts sucking up to Netanyahu all over again.
Right.
So,
hey, you know, here's the thing, too. You know what? It's a small reason to add to the discussion to be optimistic here. It always was puzzling to me why Obama went to Cairo and made such a big deal about Israel-Palestine in the first place. That's a hell of a way to start off your presidency with a challenge like that and then fail at it. And then, you know, he still says, oh, I only give it a 50-50 chance and whatever. You know, so I don't really know, you know, how hard he really wants the thing, but
pissed off by the fact that the Israelis screwed him after that speech.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, is he has nothing to lose, and he does have all the power in the world. So,
right.
Could be.
I mean, let him use it for good for a change. I mean, and on foreign policy, a president does have more latitude than domestic policy. We see how much he can do on health care. Even if he decided tomorrow that he wants to, you know, have single payer like our Canadians or whatever, can't do it. President, you can't. I mean, I think on foreign policy, it's like he can get away with a lot more.
Well, that's why presidents love wars so much. It's because it makes them the center of all attention instead of legislators.
Yeah. Presidents love the freedom to go to war. Well, you know, but the flip side of that is they can negotiate too when they want to. And when they realize that if they ever got involved with a war with Iran, we would be involved in that war for 20 years, it would never end. It would never end. That's not the kind of war they want.
Yeah. Well, now, after Obama's the people and Obama's victories against AIPAC here, have they really taken it on the chin bad? Do you think their bluff is called and now we can rank them back below the NRA and the AARP or don't count them out yet?
Oh, yeah, definitely don't count them out yet. There is so much. I mean, look, the front runner for the Democratic nomination and probably the front runner for president is Hillary Clinton. And I always forget the guy's name. Her biggest funder is this. What's his name? This Israeli guy who invented Power Rangers. He's a billionaire.
Chaim Sabin, the guy behind
Sabin.
The Brookings Institution.
Yeah, he owns the Brookings Institute. I love that. The Brookings Institute used to be an independent think tank, and then Chaim Sabin bought it. Right. And now it's the Chaim Sabin Brookings Institute. But he is her biggest backer. I mean, he plays the Sheldon Adelson role for Hillary. So I'm not sure that we can say that. We can't say that AIPAC is licked. We can just say that it's in the process of being licked. I mean, hey, that's something.
Well, you know, the thing of it is, too, is it used to be nobody could talk about this at all, but now it's okay to talk about this. I got MJ will vouch for me. I'm no anti-Semite. I just think this is real and it's important to talk about. So what?
MJ only lost his job for talking about it. But, you know, I wouldn't recommend anybody who worries about job security talking too much about this. I mean, that's a topic for another day.
It's getting better.
It is getting better. I mean, you know, I found that, you know,
you're great. Thanks, MJ. We're out of time. Appreciate it. Love you.
Okay.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm him. My website is scotthorton.org. I keep all my interview archives there. More than 3,000 of them now going back to 2003.
Really?
You can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /Scott Horton Show. And we're live here, of course, on Liberty Express Radio, 3 to 5 Eastern Time, weekdays. Okay, next guest on the show is Tom Z. Colina. He is Research Director at the Arms Control Association. That's armscontrol.org. Welcome to the show, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today. I appreciate it, and I really like this journalism that you did here about missile defense, U.S. missile defense. I guess it's kind of an op-ed, but it's got a hell of a lot of facts in it. I'll call it journalism. U.S. missile defense isn't ready for prime time. And the first thing I thought when I saw that headline, I got to say, is, but wait, isn't it the future right now? We're living in 2014. It's got to be ready by now, this missile defense. And you know what's funny, too, is I'll go ahead and say at the beginning here, is I always thought this whole thing is stupid. Shoot a bullet with a bullet. It never did work. They rigged all their tests. Everybody's known all this for decades and decades. What a big joke it was, and it's too bad. Reagan and Gorbachev could have made a deal to get rid of all of their H-bombs if only Reagan hadn't believed in this ridiculous myth of the missile defense. But then I was thinking, you know what? Maybe I'm completely wrong about that, because they do have air-to-air missiles that fighter jets use to shoot down other fighter jets. That seems like it's pretty complicated mathematics to get a Sidewinder to hit what it's supposed to hit, a MiG going Mach something or other and juking and turning. So maybe, you know, if you do the equations right, you can figure out how to hit a bullet with a bullet. But then, so that begs the question, what's the problem? If it still doesn't work, it's still not ready for prime time, that is an actual threat, in 2014, Tom?
Well, I think you're quite right. I mean, it turns out that hitting a bullet with a bullet is really quite difficult to do. And the Pentagon has been trying for decades now and has spent, you know, tens of billions of dollars trying to do this. And what's happening is that the tests that are being done are simply failing. The most recent test that was last July failed to hit its target. The two previous tests in 2010 both failed to hit their targets. Now, these are tests. These are scripted, unchallenging tests to just see if the system that we already have deployed is working, and they've missed now three times in a row. So it doesn't give you a lot of confidence that if this test or this system were used under an actual attack, which would be a more stressing environment, you know, than these scripted tests. Again, if we can't hit the scripted tests, we're not going to hit the real target in a real attack.
Right. All right, well, a couple of things here. First of all, only tens of billions? Because I would have thought more than that. But then second of all, hey, what's a few hundred billion compared to saving Los Angeles? So, you know, maybe in the test it doesn't work right because they're just shooting one missile. But what if you went ahead and shot 500 missiles at the incoming thing and just cross your fingers and hope something stops them, right? Because you're talking in, you know, probably multiple reentry vehicles or whatever. But if you got 20 warheads to shoot down and you shoot 500 missiles at it, who cares how much it costs? Shoot them damn things down, right?
Yeah, you know, there are budget realities to these things. I mean, right now, you know, the United States, I mean, really, you know, the estimate is about $40 billion that has been spent on the 30 interceptors we have deployed in California and Alaska right now. On missile defense in general, including a lot of the concepts that were promoted by President Reagan for space-based things and some of the far-out ideas, if you add up all that stuff, it's well over $100 billion. But the $40 billion figure is just for actually what we have deployed in the ground right now.
Nice.
So there's only so much money that you can spend on this stuff. And, you know, the reality is that at some point it becomes so much cheaper for an attacker to attack than for you to defend. It's simply not a cost-effective system. And that's the problem we have right now, is that even if you can get a system that could reliably hit a target in these scripted tests, it's relatively easy for an adversary, you know, even a less developed country like North Korea, to put up decoys. Because what's happening is these intercepts are happening in space. Okay, they're not happening in the atmosphere like a fighter jet or a, you know, or a missile, that kind of thing. They're happening in space where things are floating along and there's no drag. So something like a balloon flies at the same speed and trajectory as the real target, the warhead you're trying to hit, as does, you know, the debris from the missile itself. This is all kind of traveling around in what's called a threat cloud. And so the interceptor has to kind of get up there in space and look and say, well, which is the real target and which is the fake one? And there's no, the system really can't tell what's the real thing from the fake thing. And so, in fact, we already have that kind of situation where, you know, the interceptor goes up there and it doesn't see, doesn't have one target. It's really got about 25, and it's got to figure out which one's the real one. And so you quickly see that the economics of this don't work out, that it's way cheaper to put up, you know, 25 real and false targets. Yet we're putting up interceptors that, you know, are costing hundreds of millions of dollars each, and you simply can't keep going with that.
So in other words, it's not just a matter of, you know, the cost of trying to save Los Angeles or an American city from being lost or something like that. It's that it can't work. That just compared to the countermeasures against it, it will never be able to keep up with the countermeasures, not at the rate of spending required to keep up with countermeasures. That's
it probably can't work, and it certainly can't work cost effectively. And I guess the more direct answer is that there are alternatives that are much more effective. So, for example, we have the United States has a nuclear arsenal of offensive weapons. The reason we have it is to deter countries like North Korea from attacking the United States. So it's wrong to think that these missile defenses, which have proven to be ineffective, are the only thing standing between us and attack from North Korea. That's not the case at all. The reason, well, one of many reasons that North Korea would choose not to attack us is because they would know if they did, they would get attacked back. And not only that, they'd get decimated because we have, you know, literally thousands of nuclear weapons that we can launch in North Korea. I mean, that's the main reason why a country like North Korea isn't going to attack the United States, not because there's a missile defense system standing there.
Well, and it's also important to note that the reason that anybody's even talking about North Korea is because America has no actual enemies anywhere in the world. At worst, China and Russia are our frenemies. They're our trading partners and our strategic partners on all kinds of projects all over the world. And, you know, certainly between us and China, we can't do without each other, economically speaking, now. And there's really, we're out of continents where there might be bad guys lurking with ICBMs here. The only real threat, well, not the only one, but the worst threat, of course, would be some kind of accidental war between us and Russia, or maybe if there was some severe change of regime here or there in you know, some midterm future, some kind of thing like that, where the Cold War is back on or worse, something like that. But otherwise, that's why we're talking about defending from North Korea, is because they're the only ones that we can even conceive of who might someday get a rocket that can reach far enough to hit Anchorage or something, right?
Right, and you know, make no mistakes. I mean, the North Koreans are working on that capability. You know, no doubt there is a potential threat that could be mounted from North Korea. They're working both on the missiles and the nuclear weapons. But my main point is that even if they achieve that capability, you know, they'll be deterred from using it because we have much greater forces than they do. Their main goal is to get attention for themselves, kind of like the bad kid who can only behave badly to get attention for that.
Right. Well, and there are other alternatives like negotiate away the threat, that kind of thing too. But I wonder if we go back to the hypothetical of a North Korean or even, you know, because the Chinese, they don't have that many nukes. Say if we got in a war with them and they shot, what, a couple of dozen nukes at us, maybe, you know, the possibility of being able to shoot those down. What about, you know, my understanding, and my friend Gordon Prather, he used to make nuclear weapons, so what he told me was, forget all this shooting heat-seeking missiles in outer space. What are we talking about here? What you need is an enhanced radiation thermonuke, a neutron bomb. You set off those in space, and that's the only chance you had. Not that it's foolproof or anything, but that's the best chance you have in knocking out incoming ICBMs. And if you're talking about missile defense that's not about shooting off enhanced radiation devices in space, then you're just wasting money.
Well, you know, I think there's a general sense the American public is not going to be supportive of launching nuclear warheads into space. So from a political perspective, that tends to have been a non-starter. Plus the fact that once you detonate one nuclear warhead in space, you pretty much blind all your other interceptors. So it's very difficult to then...
I see. Oh, sorry. Yeah, that wasn't supposed to start up quite so loud. You can finish your statement there.
Anyway, so nuclear interceptors are pretty much a non-starter, and so we're stuck with the non-nuclear sort of bullet-to-a-bullet situation, which has so far not panned out.
Right. All right. Hold tight right there. We got to take this short break. We'll be right back, everybody, with Tom Kalina, research director at Arms Control Association, armscontrol.org. Hey, y'all. Scott here. Some stock market investors are making money hand over fist, while others sit on the sidelines afraid of the dangers. Are you looking for answers? Before you invest $1, I'd like you to take the time to watch this new video from Martin Weiss at moneyandmarkets.com. The video names the 7 riskiest and 4 safest major stocks in America. Learn from the experts and invest wisely. Go to crisis16.com. That's crisis16.com. Hey y'all, Scott here. Like I told you before, the Future Freedom Foundation at FFF.org represents the best of the libertarian movement. Led by the fearless Jacob Hornberger, FFF writers James Bovard, Sheldon Richman, Wendy McElroy, Anthony Gregory, and many more write the op-eds and the books, host the events, and give the speeches that are changing our world for the better. Help support the Future Freedom Foundation. Subscribe to their magazine, The Future of Freedom. Or to contribute, just look for the big red donate button at the top of FFF.org. Peace and freedom.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. Don't you want a bust of Murray Rothbard for your desk at work? A Ludwig von Mises for your bookshelf at home? A Harry Brown, a Ron Paul as a gift for a friend? Check out these awesome busts of your libertarian heroes at myheroesthink.com. They come in 6 or 9 inch sizes and now in color, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf in my office and I love it. Just click the banner ad in the right margin at scotthorton.org and enter promo code ScottHortonShow to save $5. That's myheroesthink.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm him. Talking with Tom Kalina from the Arms Control Association. That's armscontrol.org. And we're talking about the missile defense boondoggle and possible threats and what can be done and this kind of thing. And I notice here you have a headline. I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to read this. But it's Hill to Fix, Not Expand, Missile Defense. And so I'm curious as to what fix you think there might be.
Sure. Well, one of the interesting debates that's been happening on Capitol Hill lately is that there are some members of Congress that wanted to expand the missile defense system to right now it's deployed on the West Coast, Alaska and California, and they wanted to build another site somewhere on the East Coast. But the problem with that, there are many problems with that, but one of the main problems is that the technology we have on the West Coast doesn't really work yet, so it makes no sense to export it to the East Coast and build another system until at least you got the technology down. And so what Congress decided to do in its defense bill for this current year is to reject that idea of building an additional site on the East Coast and instead take that money and actually add money to the budget to fix the current system that we already have. And the key part of it that people focus on as really being not reliable is this little thing. Well, it's not that little, but it's the thing that goes on the tip of the missile. It's called a kill vehicle. Very, very exciting to name there. The kill vehicle is actually the thing that goes up into space and looks around and tries to find the warhead and actually smash into it so that it explodes. And that's a very difficult thing to do. And the kill vehicle we have now, there's actually two different designs of it. Neither one have proven reliable. So what Congress wants to do is spend money to redesign that part so that it works better. Unfortunately, the Obama administration is planning to expand the system we have on the West Coast today by about 50% using these same kill vehicles that are unreliable.
So, in other words, you're saying they have a pretty good idea of how they could do it better. They want to use the old kind. I think you say in your current article here, they want to use the old ones as the targets to shoot at, but instead of going ahead with the redesign and making some that might work better, or maybe that would be another way, so I'll let you answer that if you want, but they're going to just go ahead and expand what they already know doesn't work.
Well, they're doing both at the same time, concurrently. So in other words, they are working on a redesign, but they're not going to wait for that redesign to deploy or expand the system, which I think doesn't make a lot of sense. What they should do is go ahead with the redesign, prove it to be effective, and then if it is effective, then you go ahead and expand your system with the newly designed kill vehicle on it. I don't see why you'd want to expand the system until you're ready to do that. Now, some might say, well, the threat is such that we can't wait. You know, let's not make the perfect enemy of the good. We have this threat from North Korea. You know, let's expand now. Well, in fact, you know, the threat from North Korea isn't really there yet. It may be emerging, but North Korea hasn't yet tested a missile that could get over here. If they did, they'd only have ones or twos. Well, you already have 30 interceptors deployed on the West Coast, depending on how effective you think they are. So there is a defense of some kind already in place. And again, as I said before, the main thing that protects us from a North Korean attack is the fact that we can retaliate with massive force.
Right. Well, and I mean, if they were to try to nuke Seoul right now, they'd have to take it there on the back of a flatbed truck, right?
Well, you know, I mean, they have short-range missiles that they could use. We don't really even know that North Korea has a warhead that they could put on a missile. That's not sure either. So there's a lot of unknowns about North Korea. But certainly, you know, there are reasons to be concerned about North Korea. We need to worry about that. But expanding missile defense at this point is not the answer.
Well, whatever happened to the airborne laser project? That was going to be really cool. We could blow those ICBMs up as they leave the silos from a 747, right?
Yeah, I mean, those kind of ideas turn out to be tremendously expensive and not very effective and have their own vulnerabilities. So you could imagine having lasers floating around in space. They're tremendously vulnerable, and what they basically discovered is that as you put stuff in space, it becomes much easier just to shoot those things down than to ever try to mount an attack, you know, before you would do that. So that's why, you know, attention is really focused on ground-based interceptors that would launch up and try to intercept things in deep space. But even that is pretty hard.
Right. And now, why is it exactly so hard? Is it just because of all the dummies? Because, again, you know, a Sidewinder missile, that's 1970s technology or something. Those things can take out a MiG spinning all around, right?
Again, you're doing this in space. It's not the same as doing something in the atmosphere.
Right.
But I have to say, that, you know, the main reason is that in this kind of offense-defense relationship, the offense always has the advantage because they choose when to attack and they choose the technology to attack with. In other words, the United States in this case, which would be the defender, puts its defenses into the ground, and it's, you know, we're an open society, so pretty much people know what the technology is and what the sensors are that we put in the ground. So then the attacker says, okay, you've deployed a defense with an infrared seeker or an infrared sensor on your missile. So I'm going to deploy a decoy that you can't see with that infrared sensor, and I'll launch that. And so so you've always got this part of this story where the offense always has the advantage because they can go. They go last. They choose when to attack, and they choose what to attack with. So the defense is always putting out technology that is going to be, in a sense, yesterday's technology by the time it's out there. Plus the fact that
so in other words, a laser costs a lot, but plating your rocket in chrome is pretty cheap.
That's right. So the United States is doing very expensive stuff that there tends to be very simple countermeasures to. That the enemy can respond to.
And by the way, is chrome plating your rocket a pretty effective countermeasure? That was my idea.
You know, I don't know about that one, but there are other ones. For example, if you had one of the reasons why airborne lasers prove to be pretty ineffective is that when rockets are launching, they tend to spin. Okay, so if you've got a laser and you're focusing it on a missile casing, you need to focus it on one spot for a long period of time to get hot enough to rupture the missile. Well, if the missile is spinning, you can't do that.
Right.
So it's these little simple things that really sort of mess up these grandiose ideas.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. Well, now, so let me ask you this. Obviously, you're a real expert on, you know, all kinds of issues here as far as nuclear weapons and everything else. So why is it, do you think, that America still holds on to so many thousands of nukes, some deployed, some still on the shelves, and why we still have pretty much the same nuclear Cold War stance against the Russians as we did back in the days of the USSR? Is there something wrong with the incentive structure in Washington, D.C. that keeps it this way, or this is really the best idea anyone has for keeping America safe?
That's a great question, and it's a complicated question. But I would say the main reason is that, you know, the political situation is such that it's very hard for politicians to change things, particularly in the national security sphere, because people are so much in the mindset of, well, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, and if you make any changes, you might make America unsafe and this kind of thing, which is really unfortunate because we could save so much money and make ourselves so much safer by reducing U.S. nuclear forces and bringing Russia down along with us. But instead, because we have this go-slow attitude and politicians that promote these ideas are basically accused of sacrificing or endangering U.S. security, that politicians are essentially gun-shy and don't want to push on this too much out of fear of being called weak on defense. But in fact, these are very pro-defense arguments, because if we, the United States, reduces its forces, Russia can be encouraged to reduce its forces as well. And that's what reduces the danger to the United States, is bringing down the Russian forces. Plus, I mean, we're going to spend somewhere around $300 billion on nuclear forces over the next decade, $300 billion with a B. And we can reduce that dramatically if we simply downsize the level of forces that we have. So we can save money and we can actually make ourselves more secure at the same time by reducing the arsenals and the warheads.
Mm-hmm. And then let me ask you this. Is it true that in Washington, D.C., the hydrogen bomb lobbyists work just the same as any other lobbyist, whether for agriculture or for medicine or guns or Israel or anything else, where they go up there and they work as hard as they can to get as big of a piece of the pie as they can, and it doesn't really matter that they're selling weapons that could destroy all humanity and maybe life on Earth forever? It's just the same as any other business. They're just here to seek their rent.
You know, I mean, there aren't nuclear weapons lobbyists. You wouldn't see someone with a business card, you know, that says, you know, nuclear weapons are us on it. But there are certainly entities in the federal government who have an interest in nuclear weapons being perpetuated and having them be there for a long time. For example, you know, you've got land-based missiles deployed at missile bases, and those missile bases mean jobs to members of Congress. You've got, you know, submarine contracts worth, you know, billions of dollars in key states, and to those states those are, you know, major job contracts right there. So there's a vested interest in maintaining the level of nuclear weapons that we have, and the forces against the forces that are calling for reductions in nuclear weapons simply aren't as well financed as the forces that are building nuclear weapons. And that's really, we have a mismatch right now between those that are calling for arms reductions and arms control and those that are calling for modernization of the weapons that we have.
Right.
I mean, it's not just...
Well, there's a lot of star power behind... it's not just Jane Fonda and a bunch of liberals and stuff. It's George Shultz and Henry Kissinger say we ought to start downsizing down to very, very few nukes, right? Or no?
That is true. I mean, there's a lot of big names out there, but it's not enough to take on, at least at this point, the industrial and political interests that are focused on sustaining the stockpile we have today.
Right. All right. Well, I'm sorry we're out of time. Thanks very much for the very interesting conversation here. Appreciate it, Tom.
It's been a pleasure, Scott. Thanks for having me.
All right, everybody. That is Tom Kalina. He is Research Director at the Arms Control Association. That's armscontrol.org. And he's got this one at Defense One. 1, the word 1, U.S. missile defense isn't ready for prime
time. So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Hey y'all, Scott here. Anti-imperialism is at the center of libertarianism, as long as we keep it that way. So if you're part of a libertarian group, how about having me out to give a talk on the wars? I work cheap, and I'm good on everything. I've even been known to change a mind or two with some of these things. Check out some examples at scotthorton.org/speeches, and email scott@scotthorton.org for more information. By the way, this February 15th, the Future Freedom Foundation is having John Glazer and I give a talk at the International Students for Liberty Conference in Washington. Come on out and say hi. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for thebumpersticker.com. I created it but quickly sold to Rick so I could do this instead. In the decades since, he's made one hell of a great company. Thebumpersticker.com makes digitally printed, photo-quality, full-color bumper stickers for your band or your business, as well as magnets, adhesive vinyl decals, and labels for products and industrial use, and your political cause or campaign, too. Thebumpersticker.com also offers full custom graphic design for bringing your idea to reality. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. And tell them you heard it here. Alright, you guys. Welcome back to the dang old show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. So, yeah, anti-war stuff. Let's talk about anti-war stuff. First of all, we gotta talk again. I'm sorry. I gotta talk about the war on drugs, man. And I'm, you know what? This is, for me, this kind of stuff got me interested in politics in the first place when I was young. Republicans sell drugs. Well, Democrats, too. But when I was a kid, it was the Republicans. And Ronald Reagan was the biggest cocaine dealer in the world. And that's a fact, Jack. And so, what in the hell is this? You import all the cocaine, and then every young black person who dares to try some has to go and rot in a cage in the prime of their life? What in the... Republicans are mean. Mean. And this is, you know, in the 1980s when I was a stupid little kid. I knew better than this crap. Locking people up for using and trading in drugs. It's criminally stupid. And I mean on the part of the people who believe in it. The people who are lying to you and getting away with murder, waging this war on drugs. That makes perfect sense. You know, I guess if I sold armored personnel carriers for a living, I'd be for keeping pot illegal too. I guess if I was a rep for a police union, well, first of all, I'd shoot myself in the face, but second of all, I would probably be for the war on drugs. But no decent human being who has thought about this for a minute is for this drug war. And I'm sorry, because I can already hear it in my voice. I sound so damn patronizing, but I've been over this for a long, long time now. The reason that this talented actor, Philip Seymour Hoffman, is dead is because he was shooting up black market junk. And now maybe you think he shouldn't have been a junkie. But the reason he died of it is because it was black market stuff. And he got the dose wrong. He wasn't trying to kill himself, most likely. 99%. It was an accident. Same as everybody else who overdoses on heroin. It's an accident. But if he could have just gone and scored at Walgreens, this never would have happened. And the man is dead. And it's not just that, oh, he won't be in movies, and what are they going to do about part three of the saga thing they're doing and whatever. No, he had three children. Young children, according to a TV lady. And he's dead. Dead. Because what? Somebody believes that they're sending a message to somebody else that you shouldn't do heroin? For God's sake, man. You know what? Here's the truth. Honestly, you want to know the truth? Everyone knows better than to be a junkie. Some people choose to be one anyway. Maybe they got something that hurts so bad that they would rather be a junkie than deal with it. And maybe it's none of your damn business. Maybe you were born owning you, and junkies were born owning themselves, and it's not up to you. But imagine, seriously, imagine the prison time that a pharmacist would get if that pharmacist said, here, let me get you some pharmacological grade heroin somewhere and make sure that at least you're getting a safe supply here because you're my favorite actor. That pharmacist would go to prison for decades. And if that pharmacist resisted, the cops would kill that pharmacist to death with their guns. Because it's a crime to sell heroin to Philip Seymour Hoffman, who's a big boy and can decide whether now's the time he wants to be doing heroin or not. So, anyway, the only reason that's newsworthy is because it's newsworthy because this famous actor died. But what about somebody's daughter just died of a heroin overdose yesterday, too? As somebody else's young son. You know, I'm not saying it's impossible to overdose on, you know, pure, real drugs. Of course it is. But not because of flip a coin and guess miss dosage. Well, you ain't gonna know how pure it is till you shoot it once, right? So, hot shot, that's what they call it. And here's the part that really has got me, that makes me want to talk about this on the radio so bad, is that all over the media, they're talking about, yeah, he had the ace of spades and the ace of hearts and the ace of this and the ace of that and this terrible heroin that killed this terrible guy, but nobody is really smart enough to divide four by two and say, well, wait a minute, man. It was prohibition that killed him. That's stupid, dude. And by the way, you know, I don't approve of heroin addiction. And if you were a friend of mine and you were addicted to heroin, I would recommend that you try to cool it as soon as you can, man. But the truth is, I'm not sure where I picked this up from. I think I might have made this up myself, and I don't even have a brother. But somewhere, I guess I was trying to think, I was probably in the middle of an argument, and I was trying to think of what's the exception to the non-aggression rule in the case of drug addiction. And the only exception I can really think of is, if it's your little brother, then by all means, beat the crap out of him until he does what you say. At that point, I mean, not really is it okay for you to aggress against your little brother, but it's certainly not within my jurisdiction to stop you from beating up your own little brother. So if your little brother's a junkie, which he might be a junkie because you beat him up all the time in the first place, you should think about that. But if your brother's a junkie, by all means, kidnap him, tie him up, make him kick, make sure he doesn't die tied up, you know, feed him fruits and vegetables and stuff. Whatever. Do what you will with your family, you know. I mean, we're talking about somebody old enough to be a junkie. They're old enough for you to kick their ass. But other than that, it's just not up to you. Because other people are not your property, man. That's pretty simple. I don't know why that's so complicated. And, you know, the polls, I see the polls all the time. Do you think maybe we should legalize pot? Is it better than alcohol? Is it not? No. But nobody ever asks Is it within the legitimate authority of the nation state to outlaw pot in the first place? To outlaw heroin in the first place? And by the way, it's America. I mean, other states do it too, and other states would if we didn't, not all of them. But it's really America that has forced the drug war regime on the planet Earth. The reason that there's narco, terrorism, murderer, crime lords crawling all over Afghanistan right now is because, for whatever, you know, rigged governmental reasons, first of all, there's a giant profit motive in the black market of selling heroin, but also, certainly there are protectionist measures creating bottlenecks in the opiate market for medical use. And for God's sake, there's 7 billion people in the world, which means what? Like right now, at least a couple of million of them are screaming in horrible pain, right? Where's the affordable morphine and all the other derivatives of the poppy plant, you know? You could be making muffins out of that stuff. Why is it all black market heroin and overdoses and death and violent wars between criminals? Because of the U.S. government, mostly. And its global prohibition on the drug trade. Which, again, in my days, the CIA ran the whole damn thing in Latin America. The only reason that they took out Noriega was because he stopped cutting the CIA guys in on his profits and started going rogue. But he was a good little cocaine dealer before that. Don't be stupid. And, of course, Gary Webb and the Dark Alliance series, which somebody has saved the Dark Alliance series. Man, I should save all that on my website. I'm going to make a note of that on my hand right now. Fair use stuff, man. I'm going to save those articles, the San Jose Mercury News articles. And, of course, the politics of heroin, Alfred McCoy, about the Golden Triangle during Vietnam. And all the heroin trade back, and all the corruption back then. Well, it's wrong, man. It's a damn sin. And you know what's funny? Here's about this, man. What if you had a counterfactual? Where what if I could go back in time and strangle Richard Nixon to death in his crib? Or, you know, in his 20s. Is that a little easier? Anyway, so if I could go back in time and somehow magically, with or without the murder of Richard Nixon, I could somehow, convince the Americans better than to embark on this ridiculous drug war. Think how different a world we would live in now. You know, never even mind the terror war. The reason, the underlying excuse for the militarization of law enforcement and the shredding of the Bill of Rights of all Americans, drug users, and the rest of us too, is the war on drugs. That's where the no-knock raid into your house came from. That's where the SWAT team, the Special Weapons Assault Team, which is just a special forces squad, basically. They're trained by the SEALs and them, and Delta, you know. And these, the big city ones anyway. And, their job supposedly was just taking out the bad guys at a hostage crisis at a bank, right? But now they serve every felony warrant, is crashing in the door and hurting people, shooting children, shooting wives, shooting dogs. Terrorizing the people of this country. It's all because of the drug war. That's where it all came from. Not that it ever really was Andy Griffith and Don Knotts patrolling your neighborhood. But what turned these men really into soldiers? Not even paramilitary, but just military men wearing deputy sheriff shirts. It's the war on drugs. The war on drug users, the war on drug businessmen in this country. It's madness. It's suicide. And I'm sorry that I don't cover this issue enough. I mean, in a way, I rather pick on my government for picking on foreigners. More like Americans doing it to themselves, but not really, more like some of us doing it to the others. But it's time to knock it off. It's time to legalize heroin and cocaine and the rest of it right now. It's time to evolve this idea, as Bill Hicks would say.
Hey, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters.
As Bill Hicks said 25 years ago.
Really couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first. And just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.com. Or go to scotthorton.org/Amazon.
The Emergency Committee for Israel, Brookings, Heritage, APAC, WINEP, GINSA, PNAC, CNAS, the AEI, FPI, CFR, and CSP. It sure does seem sometimes like the war party's got the foreign policy debate in D.C. all locked up. But not quite. Check out the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. They put America first, opposing our government's world empire, and especially their Middle Eastern madness. That's the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it easy and 100% anonymous. Just deposit the money into their account at any Bank of America, Wells Fargo, or credit union with shared branching, and then just email them a picture of the receipt with your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. A simple, clean, anonymous way to get Bitcoins. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com.
Give me that microphone. One flex, the other to swing. One flex, the other to swing. Give me that microphone. One flex,
okay, the other to swing. Okay, okay. Now we gonna do it like this, and you don't stop.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. And, you know, I don't know who's been really good on the Afghan trade, the Afghan heroin trade under American occupation. It's an absolute fact that the Taliban just basically eradicated this stuff. There was no rule of law they followed. They destroyed the crops. That was it. Their war on drugs was total. And ever since the occupation, it's been a bigger and bigger crop every single year, with maybe slight variation for weather. But I'm pretty sure it's every single year, it's just bigger and bigger and bigger. And at the very least, the Americans are fighting for these people who are at the top of the chain of the poppy business in Afghanistan. Who else are they fighting over there? Now, whether the CIA... See, in the 1980s... Congress told Reagan, you cannot spend money on the death squads in El Salvador and Nicaragua. So Ronald Reagan's guys said, well, and probably Reagan himself too, I guess, said, hey, so let's sell missiles to the Ayatollah Khomeini. You know, treason! And let's sell a bunch of cocaine to the blacks of Los Angeles. And then we'll take the money and we'll spend the money on the death squads down there, you know, the butchers of women and children down there in El Salvador and Nicaragua. They needed the money. But right now, why does the CIA, they got as much money as they want in the whole world. Other than, you know, individual CIA agents running the drug business for their own profit, or the CIA or other government agencies helping run the drug business for their political reasons. Like, hey, let's increase the supply to Russia. Increase the supply to China. I'm not certain that's true. I'm not saying that's necessarily the policy, but that would make sense. In fact, Eddie Griffin, the comedian, he's got a great rant about American foreign policy in Afghanistan over there and keeping the Chinamen high on opium and stuff. I'm not certain if he's right about that, but it was cool. I like listening to a comedian who actually not just knows about stuff, but hates it because of how wrong it all is. I like that guy, Eddie Griffin. He's funny, dude. Anyway. But I don't know exactly which all Americans are in on this, but I do think that it's certainly worth entertaining the possibility that individual personalized corruption within the U.S. government is a great part of why we're still at war over there. People who work in the national security state who are involved in the heroin market in Afghanistan, they got to keep this thing going as long as they can.
That may have a lot to do with why we're still there now. But you know what's funny? Go back to 2009, and this has come up again in the news because of Robert Gates' book, where he talks about the botched putsch of 2009 against Hamid Karzai, which we covered and laughed about on this show, how obvious and how ham-handed it was and how horrible it all was. There was a headline in the New York Times that says, Wali Karzai is a CIA agent and a drug dealer. And the headline might as well have said, CIA called us up and told us to run a big headline called Wali Karzai is a CIA agent and a drug dealer. I mean, otherwise, what the hell else was it doing on the top of the front page of the New York Times? It was there because the CIA put it there. And it was there because they were trying to discredit Hamid Karzai by pointing out that his brother is a CIA agent. What's less legitimate than that? Oh, and he pushes the dope that's destroying your community. And then no one was supposed to notice that. So, you guys got lots of heroin kingpins on your payroll, huh? Like the brother of the president of Afghanistan, the sock puppet dictator that America installed in power there back in 2002 and kept ever since? Okay, guys. I think what you just said is, we are guilty of dealing heroin. Sincerely, the CIA. Wali Karzai's dead now. I forget how they say he died. Was he shot in the back of the head? Or maybe was it some black market stuff he OD'd? And remember, Eikenberry, Ambassador Eikenberry, who was at the start of the Obama surge in Afghanistan, the escalation of the war over there. He was the State Department guy. I forget if he was working for Holbrooke or hated Holbrooke or whatever his role. But anyway, I'm 99% sure it was Eikenberry that wrote about accusing Karzai of being a junkie himself. And in fact, in Michael Hastings' reporting on the runaway general was the article, but there's a lot of other stuff in there. And they talk about how McChrystal really tried to work with Karzai. And, more than anybody else had patience for him, really decided I need this guy to work with me and tried. But his guy's appraisal of Karzai was, never mind the mayor of Kabul, which people called him for all these years to make fun of the fact that he's not really the president of the country at all. He never has been, but I guess he's the mayor of Kabul. We'll give him that. Well, he said, hell, he's the mayor of his own palace is what he is. He's the head of this family, but that's about it. He's basically in the back bedroom shooting junk all day. I guess he's got the pure stuff. He's still kicking, but... and who knows if that was even really true, but seemed likely enough to me at the time. But I think it's safe to assume... Here's what you should know. It's sort of like with the 9/11 thing. It didn't have to be Dick Cheney that arranged that whole thing. All you need to know is that he might as well have. You think Dick Cheney wouldn't blow up 3,000 Americans if it meant he could get away with murdering a million more Arabs or whatever? Hell yes, he would. And just look at the way they exploited it and pretended Saddam was behind the damn thing all along. Isn't that just as bad as being behind it, pretending that a bunch of innocent people were in order to get them killed? It's the same sort of thing here, you know? They may not be deliberately running the entire heroin trade in the world, but wouldn't they? In fact, this headline might be summed up as just Scott Horton is ignorant of XYZ great journalism that really explains all this stuff. I just haven't seen it. I've seen a lot of innuendo and a lot of speculation, and I'm happy to speculate it. I again agree. The truth of the matter is, they might as well be. If you think that the CIA is not evil enough to be behind some gigantic proportion of the world's heroin trade, then boy, you need to read up on them. Because that whole thing about absolute power corrupts absolutely, and great men tend to be bad men. Yeah, Lord Acton was talking about the CIA when he said that. Must have been. So, I don't know if they're really running the world's heroin trade, but they might as well be. And then, of course, they're the same people, or at least they're the flip side of the coin of the same regime here in the United States that keeps it all illegal and keeps our favorite actors falling dead of it. And some of our friends, too. And just think about going to prison for decades for being a junkie and maybe selling some heroin so you can afford your own habit, whatever. And then the government grabs you, kidnaps you, and locks you in a cage for decades. Your pathetic junkie life now stuck in a cage like an animal. Didn't rob an old lady. Didn't hurt anyone at all. Just got caught trading in a banned business. And, you know, they say now they're going to start adjusting the mandatory minimum sentences and all that. But, man, we need to really get a kickstart on this thing. Some senator's son needs to get busted smoking crack or something has got to give to change this narrative. I mean, just look at this. This renowned actor that everyone agrees. This renowned actor. But no one will say, you know, if heroin was legal, maybe we could start to consider it. Hey, Wolf Blitzer, etc., 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 etc. on TV. Maybe you could bring up the possibility that things would be better without a drug war. Possibility? Is that really too much to expect? A conversation about it? I mean, hell, I don't know. At the height of the AIDS scare, that wasn't enough to get him to legalize heroin. Try to, you know, medicinalize the situation as much as possible. That's made people want to clamp down even more, right? So, yeah, I don't know. That's a sad thing. But, you know, typical. And, you know, Barack Obama, back to Barack Obama. How many journalists are going to continue to follow up with him on whether it's up to him to reschedule pot from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3? As he basically at least implied he would do if he could. But he tried to pass the buck to Congress. But then journalism says, no, wrong. Congress has already passed that buck to the executive branch to write those rules, and you're the boss of the DEA, Mr. President, and if you want to reschedule pot, all you have to do is pick up your pen. Now, he basically said, oh, you know, I would if I could, but I can't. So, are people going to follow up on that? Does anybody care enough to continue to follow up and push him on that? Is anyone on TV? Will they let reason come on TV to push for legalizing heroin to explain why it's satanic evil to want to keep heroin illegal as good people are falling down dead of the ODs and AIDS too? Let's have that debate. Like they say about the NSA. Decide you want the NSA to lawlessly continue spying on everyone forever, then that's okay. We just have to have a debate. Let's debate the drug war then. As long as we're debating things. How about legalizing smack yesterday? Alright, see you tomorrow.